call the September 16th meeting of the Atascadero Planning Commission to order. Commissioner Moreno, would you lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance, please?
Ready, begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, and with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Roll call, please.
Commissioner O'Keefe?
Here.
Commissioner O'Grady?
Here.
Commissioner Moreno?
Here.
Commissioner Marks?
Here.
Commissioner Hetherington?
Here.
Vice Chairperson Jack?
Here.
Chairperson Fonzie?
Here.
All present.
Thank you, Suzanne. Our next item is approval of the...
Chairperson Fonzie?
Yes.
Motion passes 7-0.
Thank you. We now have public comment. If there's anyone in the audience that would like to speak on an item that is not on tonight's agenda and over which the commission has jurisdiction, please approach the podium and state your name for the record. Seeing none, I'm going to close the public comment portion and bring it back to the commission for planning commission business. First item would be disclosure of ex parte communications. Let's start with you, Commissioner Marks.
Visited the site on item 2.
Nothing to report.
Nothing to report.
Nothing to report.
Visited the Navajo site. Talked to no one.
Also visited the Navajo site. Spoke with no one.
Nothing to report.
Thank you. We move on to the consent calendar, and our first item would be approval of the minutes of the meeting on August 19th. Do I have a motion for approval or corrections?
Correction, please.
Commissioner O'Grady?
I don't mean to be picky, but if you could change the gender of the pronoun that refers to me. I'm sorry.
You're not supposed to catch that.
Let's see. I think it's on page 8.
This is equal opportunity.
If you could change at first paragraph up top of the page, if you could change she to he, I would dearly appreciate that.
That's part of the commission norms, isn't it?
Any other corrections? Do I have a motion for approval of the minutes?
So moved.
Moved by Commissioner Jack?
Second.
Second by Commissioner Marks. Roll call, please.
Commissioner Hetherington?
Yes.
Commissioner Moreno?
Yes.
Commissioner O'Grady?
Yes.
Commissioner O'Keefe?
Yes.
Commissioner Marks?
Yes.
Vice Chairperson Jack?
Yes.
Chairperson Fonzie?
Yes.
Motion passes 7-0.
Thank you, Suzanne. We'll move on to public hearings. Our first and only item is a reconsideration of a planned unit development at 7705 Navajoa Avenue. Staff report, please.
Good evening, Commissioners. This next item before you is a reconsideration of a project that was previously approved in 2006 and has since expired based on the time frame set forth in those adopted resolutions. So tonight we are reconsidering the project as it was proposed on the 18th of 2006. That was the date that was issued in the notice of approval letter to the applicant, and so that's the date that he thought that the entire project expired on. He did file a map extension on January 31st, which was a few days short of that first approval date, but he thought it was in timeframes based on that February 14th date. But because those timelines are fairly strict in the Subdivision Map Act, this must come before you as a reconsideration tonight. So I will go over the project details as if it were a new project being presented for those of you who are not familiar with the project. The project site is located at Navajoa. It actually comprises two current parcels and was proposed to be subdivided into a 5-lot planned development. It is in the multifamily zone. It currently is zone PD25 because that zone change approval does not expire. So that zone change designation is currently on the parcel. And it is in the medium density residential general plan designation. This is a current aerial of the site and the surrounding area. As you can see, there's a planned development that was recently completed to the west of the project, and a four-unit multifamily condominium development that was recently completed to the east of the project area. And these here are commercial properties along Morrow Road. So as I said, it's a five-unit, five-lot planned development on a little more than a half-acre site in total with the two lots together. It is designed to meet the PD 25 standards, which includes a decorative parking court, street trees along the parking court, and a landscape feature at the terminus of the court, similar to some other PDs that we've seen recently come through designed to those same standards. Each unit has a two-car garage, and there is guest parking available on site. So this is the master plan of development that was approved in 2006 and is before you again this evening. Navajoa Avenue is located here with the five units along a shared parking court, a landscape feature at the terminus of the court as is required by the PD 25, and private yard areas in these locations. The units along Navajoa Avenue are oriented towards Navajoa Avenue. There was a recommendation from Planning Commission during the first hearing of the items back in 2006 to modify with staff those front elevations to be slightly more aesthetically pleasing. The council did incorporate that condition into the final resolution of their retention basin for the project. As you are looking at this project for reconsideration, you need to make the findings for the plan development approval, which include certain things included in the master plan, such as high-quality architectural design, landscape design, buffering between the urban and suburban, which isn't necessarily in this case, although it is compatible with the neighborhood and does transition from the commercial area that currently exists, and higher density to meet housing needs. The project is conditioned to provide in-lieu fees for affordable housing, and workforce housing is included as well. So tonight you'll be approving the five-lot tentative tract map, which is consistent with the master plan of development that's proposed as well, and it has been conditioned, as it was previously conditioned, to meet all city standards. The mitigated negative declaration for the project was certified on January 4th, 2006, during the previous approval by the City Council. The project is consistent with the general plan, which was listed in the attached staff report that you received from the original approval dates. So in order to approve this project tonight, you're looking at the conditional use permit, which acts as the master plan of development for the project, and the tentative tract map. Staff did want to note that I did go through the conditions again, and we've changed the expiration date for conditional use permits. It used to be 12 months. It's now 24. So we are recommending that you change condition number 3 in the CUP resolution to reflect 24 months, as is consistent with our current code. As always, even as this is a reconsideration, you do have alternatives for this actions this evening. You can approve the project with modified conditions of approval. You can deny the project, although it will retain the PD 25 overlay zone on the project site, or you can refer it back to staff and the applicant for additional information. So staff is recommending that you adopt both resolutions to approve the master plan of development and tentative tract map for this project, consistent with the 2006 approval of the project. And that concludes staff's presentation. The applicant's available if you have any questions.
Thank you, Kelly. Are there any questions for staff? Commissioner Jack?
Kelly, so there's been no changes in any of the ordinances or anything that would impact this since the previous approval?
That's correct. Yeah, it was done under a PD 25 overlay zone, which is one of our newer overlay zones that we've established as that are sort of reusable. So those particular overlay zones set forth setback standards, development standards, such as requiring in this particular case for the shared driveway to be of decorative paving materials. So it allows the smaller lot subdivisions in our multifamily zones and sets specific standards for their development. So other PDs in the city are more flexible because they're site-specific. This one's an actual reusable PD that sets the development standards, much like our regular ordinance does.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Commissioner O'Grady?
So the PD is necessary in order to accommodate the proposed development?
Correct, yeah. The current PD 25 overlay zoning allows the smaller lot sizes to exist.
Yeah, the development couldn't be built without the PD.
Correct.
How many affordable slash workforce housing units are there?
Our current affordable policy from City Council is to require deed restrictions of actual units when the project has 10 units or more within the development. So this wouldn't trigger that requirement to actually deed restrict a unit. They are allowed to have the in-lieu fee option, in which they would pay 5% of the construction valuation of each unit into our affordable housing in-lieu fee payment fund. The workforce housing condition, the way our current policy is set up, is that they sort of designate at least half of the units for sale to count people who work or live in the city before they market those to people outside of the area.
So for workforce housing, the price is what it is. It's just it has to be offered to
Correct.
The folks you just described.
Correct.
So because there are not 10 units, then there would be in-lieu fees.
Correct.
Right. Okay. Just curious, how many affordable housing units have been built in Atascadero with in-lieu fees?
Warren?
None have been built to date. We are collecting that money. That is part of our policy to establish how we're going to use that money. What we're probably looking at is a lot of money comes in through the redevelopment, the housing set-aside money. 20% of the money that comes through redevelopment has to be earmarked only for housing projects. Right now we've got $2 million in the bank. The city will have to move forward either in a partnership or a loan with some sort of housing project. We did do those housing study sessions earlier this year. Seems like the priority is some sort of mixed-use, affordable housing project mm-hmm. in the downtown. That's likely the type of project we're going to pursue.
Thanks. That's really useful information. Somewhere in the staff report, it was stated that when this project was heard before by the Planning Commission, it passed on a 3-2 vote. Perhaps there were two commissioners that weren't there. And I just wondered what the issues were, if you recall.
I recall I voted no for, I voted against it.
Commissioner O'Keefe?
Well, I'm just stating that I was one, Ellen Baroa, I believe, and myself were the two that voted against it.
Do you recall the
correct?
Reason?
I don't recall the exact commissioners that voted. I don't recall the exact reasoning. I do recall that there was discussion over them being two-story units adjacent to some single-family homes in the neighborhood. I know that's been an issue for this neighborhood in the past. I don't know if those are the reasons
the other
that they
issue
voted
was parking.
No.
Because that you can't have parking on one side of the street. As you know, it's quite a narrow street. So.
Okay. Last question. There also the staff report talked about the city subsidizing certain costs, and I didn't quite get all of that because I thought that. It's general plan and ordinance requirement that development pay its own way, so perhaps you could address that.
Sure. The applicant submitted his time extension in what he thought was the appropriate time frame for consideration of just a map extension process. We did do our research while we were researching, writing that staff report, and did find that the second reading date was used in that notice of approval letter, and that the map had, in fact, expired. The applicant, obviously, thinking that he acted in good faith, we had discussions with the city attorney to determine what the correct course of action would be, as it was clearly not just the applicant's error, but some staff error in that original notice of approval letter. So the city attorney sort of came to a decision with the applicant that $100, which is what the applicant paid, plus the mailing fees, and a reconsideration is about $900.
Thanks very much.
Any other questions? Just one question for you, Kelly. You mentioned that the elevations on the two front units had changed from the, you know, the Planning Commission had recommended some changes. What we see on the screen right now, does that reflect those changes or does it not?
It does not. The applicant has not submitted for the building permit process yet, which is when those changes would occur the way that the condition was written. He was to work with staff during the building permit process to modify those. So that has not occurred yet, as he hasn't gone additionally through the process yet.
Could you refresh our memory on what changes were actually recommended?
There were no exact conditions changes recommended. I believe it's in the first page of that attached staff report that lists the condition that was added. It's condition number 19. However, I know the commission was concerned with this elevation, perhaps that the chimney looked a little bit too sort of dominating on this facade, and maybe the windows could be played with a little bit to stand out a little bit more. So I believe the way the condition was worded, you asked for very minor changes for this specific elevation, just to give it a little bit more pop sort of along that Navajoa frontage.
Thank you, Kelly. Commissioner Hetherington?
Kelly, could you go back to the picture of the lot itself, the aerial view? I don't see a tree removal permit in the report. Did I miss it or?
No, I did go back and look at that, and I believe we have some documentation in our file that there were no native trees on the site. So a lot of the trees were non-native trees, and that is consistent with this neighborhood.
Okay. I have a tendency to want to condition this to not take out any trees until the actual development starts, because if they're going to do another time extension and denude it, it's not going to make the neighbors very happy, whether they're native trees or not.
Any other questions?
Yes, I have a question. Would you elaborate? You said the city attorney said because it was a staff error also. Could you expand on that? How was it a staff error? And what is being done so these kinds of things don't occur again?
Sure. The staff error was in the notice of approval letter that went out to the applicant. It misled slightly as to what the expiration date was for the map. We no longer use that second reading date in our notice of approval letters. We have a new tracking system that sort of helps us track those dates better, and so we have revised our system since then.
Okay.
Any other questions? Seeing none, I'm going to open it to the public and ask the applicant to address the commission if he or she is here.
Don't be shy.
My name is Bud Tanner. I live at 5290 Berenda in Tascadero. Do you have any questions?
Could you pick up the microphone? It's very difficult to hear you. There you go. All right. Thank you.
Do you have any questions?
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about the project, and then we'll ask you some questions if we have them.
A little bit about the project. Well, I don't know. About 5 years ago, my partner and I bought some property and was, you know, following the American dream of developing property. And I'm standing here now. So you have aerials on it. You know, we're like any other person, so.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? I think I saw Commissioner Hetherington first.
Mr. Tanner, when do you plan to break ground on this project?
Current conditions don't allow me to have a date.
Okay. Are you fine with not cutting any trees down until you're ready to break ground?
There are two or three trees on the property that need to be removed for safety. I don't like the restriction of telling me not to cut down trees. I have an arborist report from Steve. It's somewhere, Kelly. We could probably find it. There are a couple of native trees. I'm very aware of them. I'm a member of Native Tree Association, so I'm not going to remove any native trees. I have plans, worked hard to save a willow tree that's on the bottom right, a cork willow that has the screw leaves on it. It's very pretty. I like it. There are some manzanitas on the front of the property that I'm aware of. prevented a renter from taking them out. So does that...
Okay. Commissioner O'Grady?
Actually, my question was the same as Commissioner Heather.
Is it from February date or the January date? When would it start? When did my 2 years start? Today?
Good question.
Thank you.
As this is a reconsideration, it's basically approval of a new project, so it would be 2 years from today that it would expire if it's approved today.
Does it have to go in front of the City Council?
No.
Commissioner O'Keefe, did I see your hand?
Yes, you did. I understand your problem with regard to the market, but the parcel is beginning to look like a neglected rental. And if you're not going to be able to build for some time, I just think a few cosmetics to at least make the yard look better would enhance the neighborhood.
It varies from the people who live in it.
I understand that, but as a landlord, you do have choices.
I have responsibilities.
It's just a suggestion. When I see a neighborhood and one person is not taking care of their property, it does affect the other properties. So it's just being a good property owner.
Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Tanner.
All right.
Would anybody else in the audience like to speak on this item? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public portion of the hearing and bring it back to the commission for deliberation and a vote. Commissioner O'Keefe.
Yes, I have a suggestion, which I'd like the commission to consider, and that is on page 46. It's condition 14. It has to do with the issues that you brought up about the affordable housing. And it says that the unit shall be offered for sale to residents or workers within the city of Atascadero for a minimum of 60 days. During this time period, offers may only be accepted from Atascadero residents or workers. And I would like to change that to during this time period, offers may only be accepted from owner-occupied applicants, because a lot of these PDs, these were presented to us as being low-cost housing so people could buy, you know, have housing, and they've ended up being rentals. And I don't think it should be necessary to, I would also like to exclude the part about the city residents, because we have a glut of housing now, and that glut of housing is going to be there for some time.
And that you don't adjust it, just because we did work some of these things out with a former city attorney, and some of these things are a little dicey, so I wouldn't recommend that we alter it.
Thank you. Commissioner Hetherington?
Kelly, I'm a little confused. The applicant said that there were native trees. You said there weren't. We don't have an arborist report to see if the trees he wishes to cut out are dead, dying, or a threat. I would almost recommend that we continue this until we get that straightened out, unless you can clarify it.
I'm sure the applicant knows the property better than I do, and, you know, reviewing the project from 2 years ago. There are most likely the native trees he's talking about are the small oaks along the property line. I believe that the hazardous trees he was referring to were not native trees that he needs to take out for safety reasons, and so I believe that's the situation.
May I suggest a condition as follows for your consideration, Commissioner Hetherington? No tree removal shall commence until the start of construction, except where the arborist designate non-native trees need to be removed for safety reasons. Second, no native trees shall be removed, period.
Commissioner O'Keefe?
We all know that I'm a big tree hugger, and I am the president of the Atascadero Native Tree Association. However, this project is a high-density project. There's going to be pavers in there. Bottom line is there's just no room. if you require an applicant to protect a tree, that tree will be impacted so severely that it will not survive. It was approved the way it was. The manzanitas are not recognized. Those are considered bushes. They're not considered trees. I think that's an onerous it's onerous to ask the applicant to do that. He's not going to jeopardize his investment there or the tenants there. You know, if a tree is hazardous, it's hazardous. And if it's a non-native tree, that's not within our ordinance.
I agree with you, Commissioner O'Keefe, as far as the non-native trees and the threatening trees. But I think just in looking at the property when you go by on a site visit, it does look degraded. It's not. It's
ahead of time. I don't feel that this is, I do not, it's not a question of feeling. I do not believe this is a well thought out recommendation.
I would have to agree with Commissioner O'Keefe. I think we need to recognize that the property owner will look after his own best interest, and it's in his best interest to have those trees remain in case he never builds it and he sells it later. The trees and shrubbery and so forth obviously have some value. Any other deliberations or a motion?
Yes. I would like to see in the CCNRs, as we have done in the past, not excluding clotheslines in the backyard.
Is there room?
As it's a small lot PD development, there's not a ton of room, but this particular development does actually have a little bit more room than other planned developments that we've seen.
Any other thoughts? Do I have a motion? Okay, I will do one.
I will.
All right, Commissioner Jack.
Okay. I recommend adopt resolution PC 2008-0047. Approving a reconsideration of conditional use permit 2004-0139 based on findings and subject to conditions of approval, and adopt resolution PC 2008-0048, approving a reconsideration of tentative tract map 2004-0060 based on findings and subject to conditions of approval. In addition, as recommended by staff, modifying condition number 3 under the conditions of approval to 24 months from 12 months.
And would you have a problem with putting in the clotheslines, Commissioner Jett?
No.
So we are going to include CCNRs with no exclusion for clotheslines.
That's fine with me.
Do we have a second?
Second.
Seconded by Commissioner Marks.
Discussion, please.
Discussion. Commissioner O'Grady?
You know, I have no problem voting for this project, but you know, we have an exception. But since construction on this site isn't imminent, I'm not going to vote for it unless the maker of the motion will consider an extremely modest condition where the site isn't messed with unless there's good safety reasons.
Could we define messed with?
Well, removal of trees, bushes, the subject matter that we've been discussing.
May I?
Commissioner Marks?
I'd like to withdraw my second. I think Commissioner O'Grady made two recommendations. I think the first one is probably appropriate. I think that may well cover what he's been referring to. And that is not removing any trees other than those that have been deemed dangerous by the arborist. Well, the second part of the discussion we had earlier, I don't agree with.
Let's just get a point of clarification. Warren, is that within the ability of the commission to talk about non-native trees and their removal or lack thereof?
I think what you could do is, I'm not exactly sure what the interpretation is on the trees. You could make a recommendation that the tree removals, whatever tree removals are required, should occur or will occur at time of the track improvements, which is when they have permits and they're doing the grading, with the exception of hazardous trees. And I think everybody kind of will understand what that means.
I could live with that.
Okay, so we have modified the motion to state the no trees will be removed unless they're a hazard, and this would be at the time the grading occurs.
I would like to add one thing to that.
Yes.
Could there be a consultation with staff on it in case something comes up, and there could be other extenuating circumstances which would make it better looking if certain things were done, which might involve removing some non-native stuff, because it is fairly overgrown right now, mm-hmm. and so thinning it to my way of thinking would be a positive to it. But so I'd like to not have it.
Director Frace's wording, I think, is appropriate. And that within the 10% discretion that staff has, I think would cover Commissioner Jack's. In other words, if the developer went to the staff and said, hey, there's a bush or two that needs to come out, staff could do that within their 10%. But I don't want to preempt what staff's opinion would be on that.
Maybe we should ask staff.
Commissioner Moreno?
I thought we were talking about trees, and now we're bushes. And to me, this is feeling like we're putting too much restriction on this property owner who already had this project approved and through no fault of his own is back here in front of us. And I don't want to place too severe restrictions on him.
Commissioner Mark, did you have an additional comment?
No, I've just, I think it was suggested that staff take a look at it if... And I was just wondering what staff felt about it, whether they can do that.
Well, I think what staff's understand, we were just talking about trees. So we're used to dealing with hazardous trees, and we're used to dealing with trees. So I think if we just limit it to trees, we could probably make this work.
Okay.
Okay. Suzanne, are you clear on this, or do we need to make the motion once again? This
no,
is a
are we
confusing.
Taking the in reference to... removing trees, we're taking hazardous trees off, that no trees will be removed until the grading is started?
Yes.
With the exception of hazardous trees.
With the exception
with the exception of hazardous trees.
Do I have a commissioner? Oh.
I still have a question for staff. There would have been an arborist report in this report if there were trees, that native trees that were going to be impacted. I would like to see all trees that are healthy preserved, but we're doing something to an applicant here that's never been done.
I agree.
And somehow or another, this doesn't quite feel, in this case I'll use the word feel legal to me.
Well, I don't think it's necessarily a issue of legality. I think the commission can protect certain features on the site. I think from a policy standpoint, it is inconsistent with direction we've had in the past, which is to focus on native tree protection.
Further discussion, or do we have a second?
What do we have as a motion?
What we have is a motion, yes, only.
Yes.
And then we have, as further condition, 24 months rather than 12 months. We have to add to the CC&Rs no restriction on clotheslines in the backyard. And
in the event something comes up, at least has recourse without having to sit there and wait for the actual construction of the project.
Does the maker of the second agree to that modification?
No.
Okay, I still have a question. Do the maps show the existing trees? If a tree inventory was not included in the report, how is staff going to know? Who's going to watch this?
The arborist report was likely included with the mitigated negative declaration, so that's part of our project file that we can go back and review.
So there was there was a tree report?
Correct, yeah, the applicant stated that, and I believe looking at the mitigation measures for the project, there were some mitigation measures included for the native trees along the property line side.
So in other words, you didn't, this is not the complete application?
Right. With a reconsideration, okay. We don't ask the applicant for additional plan sets and reports that were submitted originally.
Well, I'm talking about all the original documents.
Right. The neg deck was already certified, so it was not included in your packet that you received this evening. We also do have the site plans and engineering documents from the original submittal, a copy of those, which do show all topo lines and vegetation on the site.
Okay. Thank you.
We have a motion.
As it was in 2006. We don't have anything that documents as it is today.
We have a motion on the table without a second, and I see Mr. Tanner has returned to the podium. Would the commission like to vote to allow the public comment portion to be opened again or not?
Sure.
Okay, go ahead, okay. Mr. Tanner.
I know pretty much for a fact that the arborist has seen the property. There are two native manzanitas on the front of the property that should not be removed. There are some freshly planted sycamores that are native that are in the middle of the property that have been approved to be removed. There is an oak tree that will remain and the willow oak that I spoke of, or willow, corkscrew willow, that is, I like the tree. It's not a native. I could take it out if I wanted to. This has already been all approved. These are through the PUD and through the tentative map plan. And we're talking about taking out shrubs and bushes and things.
Could you remain there for just a moment? I think we probably have some questions for you. I know I do.
Okay.
I think you can see the dilemma that there are.
And, you know, this was an 06 approval. Now it's 08. And you've said you don't even have a time frame for when you're going to do the work. And so all we're saying is that let's not cut down the trees until, as Director Frace's language suggests, that site grading and construction has started.
Okay. I've already been told which trees I can cut down and I can't cut down, and I can't financially cut down any more trees than I have to safely.
Sounds like we're in agreement.
Any other questions for Mr. Tanner? Thank you, sir. You may sit down. I'm closing the public portion again of the meeting and bring it back. We have a motion on the table. Do I have a second?
Could you review the motion? I don't know where we're at this point.
I don't either. Okay. Okay, so we are at item 1 and 2, but the conditions were 24 months rather than 12 months, that the CCNRs not preclude clotheslines in the backyards. And here's the big one. Okay. Condition that whatever tree removal is required will take place at the time of grading, with the exception of hazardous trees. And are we?
And if I could just suggest, in consideration of some of my colleagues' concerns, that you just add the phrase after what you just said, consistent with the previously approved arborist report.
Will the maker of the motion agree to that?
Yes.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Okay, moved by Commissioner Jack, seconded by Commissioner Marks. Roll call vote, please.
Okay. Commissioner Hetherington?
Yes.
Commissioner Marks?
Yes.
Commissioner Moreno?
May I ask a question at this point with regards to the vote?
You may.
I don't
Is your microphone on?
Oh,
Thank you. It's not that I want to vote no on this project. I'm not comfortable with the additional conditions, so can I simply abstain? Is that? I'm new to this, so.
You can abstain.
It's a yes vote, I realize.
But it's a yes vote.
I will.
Would that be Warren?
Actually, Dave Athey from Public Works is going to give you a little bit of a background on this, and I think we have a little video presentation as well.
Thank you.
Actually, so while they set that up, I'll just do the director's report real quick. So, speaking of abstentions, that issue was on the council's last agenda. That was an issue that was raised by the Planning Commission. So the council did make a final decision. It's an ordinance, so it's not actually in effect yet. It is fairly similar to our existing rule. So the way it works or will work after this ordinance becomes effective is if a commissioner has an abstention and they want to not have their vote counted, they need to announce basically they have some sort of conflict and then leave the room. At that point, their vote will count as basically a non-vote or an abstention. If you stay in the room and you abstain, your vote doesn't count unless we have a tie vote. If we have a tie vote, then the vote becomes an automatic yes vote, and then the majority would carry at that point. So that's the way it will work in approximately 45 days.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner O'Grady?
Timing. When does a commissioner have to leave the room if he does not want the vote to be counted as a yes vote?
At the beginning of the item. It's basically the same policy as for conflict of interest.
Got it. Okay.
So it's a recusal.
Basically.
Okay.
Yes.
So the last Planning Commission meeting, Commissioner Moreno and I were absent. Traditionally, commissioners abstain when they have not attended a meeting. So it's hardly appropriate for them to vote on the item. And yet, depending upon how many commissioners happen to be there that night, it's quite possible that their abstentions could be counted as yes votes for
abstentions like that. They seem like they're fairly unlikely, but they are possible. They are. I think in that case, if the commission did have a concern, especially on a consent item like the minutes where it's most likely to happen, right, we could always vote just to continue the item. Okay. So that might be your easiest way out.
Good idea.
Some other things that are going on at the next council meeting, there will be a staff report from the Public Works Department about our stormwater master permit, I think it's called. And that's part of the NPDES Phase 2 program. We are under a mandate from the local regional water quality control board to submit a plan. There's some issues with some additional requirements that all the local cities in both San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara County are dealing with right now. So we're going to have a discussion about that at the next council meeting. We're looking for some direction. I know the commission's been interested in this issue, so I just wanted to let you know that'll be on the next agenda. Your next meeting is October 7th. We have a fifth Tuesday this month, so it's 3 weeks to your next meeting. And we have a study session coming up. That's right. That'll be on the 30th. So there's a project that we're trying to put this together right now. There's an applicant with a pending plan development. It's kind of a tricky site. There's some options in terms of how the open space could be laid out. He wants the commission to have the opportunity to look at the site. So what we're going to do is schedule a special planning commission meeting for 5:30 on Tuesday, September 30th, to give the commission and public an opportunity to tour the site. He'll be showing us some different alternatives. We won't be having any discussion at the site specifically about the different alternatives. It's more of an informational gathering session. We then will put the item on your October 7th agenda for actual discussion, where you could review it and give some direction to the applicant and staff on how to proceed with the project.
Commissioner Jack.
Where is it located?
San Rafael. Kind of south side by freeway.
I assume we'll get a notice.
Yes, we're getting the notices out tomorrow, actually.
Thanks.
Excuse me, Commissioner Jack?
Warren, isn't the public forum on that night?
Isn't the public forum meeting?
I wouldn't wear heels, but it's probably not that slippery. You need hiking boots.
Okay. Will we be less than an hour, would you say?
We're going to meet on the site. The commission will be free individually to leave at any time. So if you just want to be there for a half hour, that'll be fine. If you've got some time constraints, if you could let Kelly know ahead of time, she'll work with the applicant to make sure you get most of the information. So if you need to get out of there early, and I understand if you have a forum, you might want to be out of there fairly early.
It would be nice to get some dinner beforehand. So.
Yes.
Is it possible that we could meet individually or groups of two or three at different times?
We're trying to do this as one group, just so that everybody gets the same information, sees the same thing. So that requires basically noticing it as a public meeting. So we need to, we're thinking it's best, and the applicants actually, that's their preference as well, is to just do it once.
Very good. Commissioner Hetherington?
I realize that I'm maybe the only one that works away from Atascadero and has a pretty packed work schedule. Could we ever plan these for like a Saturday morning where I wouldn't have to break the speed limit trying to get to a site? I mean, I understand that you all have overtime when you do it in the evening. Would it be different to do it, say, on a Saturday?
We've never really done anything on Saturdays. It's not that it isn't possible. I guess we could look into that in the future.
I'd appreciate it. If that's considered a special condition, I would beg that to happen.
All right.
Frankly, I'm not for Saturdays. I have commitments on Saturdays.
Okay.
I would agree. I do most of my work on Saturdays, so it would be tough for me personally.
Do we have general consensus, though, that the 30th at 5:30 will be acceptable for this site visit?
Does it have to happen now?
No. I mean, it doesn't have to happen on that date. We can find another date. We thought that was a good date just because we had an extra Tuesday.
Yeah, but with the forum, that throws everything, compresses and makes it difficult for several people.
Tell you what, we'll look for another date. We'll try to push it to, would the following week be okay if you'd have a plan? Then we also have a neighborhood meeting scheduled for next Thursday, the 25th. This is actually the applicant's meeting. It's on the Eagle Ranch specific plan. So that we're setting this up as a publicized meeting so the commission and council, both Parks and Rec and Planning Commission, can attend. We are encouraging all the commission to attend. You won't be there in an official capacity, and we'll remind you not to discuss the project in groups of three or more, that sort of thing. But we definitely want the commission to be there to hear about the project, hear the presentation and comments from the public. So hopefully most of you can make it to that.
And now, will you be sending us a notice in the email or some other route so we know where
to go? Should be getting a copy of the applicant's postcard. So Annette's working on that.
Thank you. Okay, let's go ahead with David Athey's report on low-impact development. David?
Thank you. Good evening, Chair. David Athey, Public Works Department, members of the Planning Commission, audience members. I'm here to talk about low-impact development, low-impact design. They're really interchangeable words, phrases that are really referred to, here's another phrase, best management practices for cleaning up stormwater or limiting the amount of volume of stormwater that comes off a site. So I just want to give you a little primer. Warren asked me to come and just kind of talk about this, and so I decided I got a little short video for you to watch, kind of give you an idea of what another state is doing. But why low impact design? I call it low impact design because I'm an engineer, so I like to take, you know, that's how I take hold of things. But why? Well, the Clean Water Act was passed by Congress. The U.S. EPA promulgated, their big word, came up with some nice regulations called MPDES, National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System. So MPDES requires that all cities, counties with populations 100,000 or greater, that's a phase one city, implement a stormwater management plan. Now, cities that are greater in population than 10,000, City of Tascadero, County of San Luis Obispo, Paso Robles, have to design a phase. So like I said, these are tools for development. So as like any tool, you don't use a screwdriver to pound in a nail. You don't use a hammer to pound in or to screw to put a screw in a piece of wood. So they're just tools and they're site specific. So any tool you have, you want to make sure that you, when you're on sand, you don't design your system for a complete runoff. You design your system to allow the water to infiltrate as it always did. And then if you had a clay site, you wouldn't want to design that to infiltrate all the water, because clay sites, you don't typically get a lot of infiltration water. So these tools differ from site to site, and they differ also from application. So for instance, one tool you could use if you're looking at stormwater quality would be to install what they call a bioswale. That's a fancy term for a ditch that removes pollutants, and that pollutant could be anything from sediment, motor oil, brake dust, metals off brake pads, things like that. So they're really site-specific. Another example would be a stormwater basin. Now, a stormwater basin, as you've known, you've required applicants to install these on their sites, really could deal with stormwater quality by removing sediment, because you're stealing the water. The water slows down, the heavy sediment drops out. But really, those are really aimed at quantity, the quantity of water that comes off the site. So why are we worried about quantity? Well, quantity, we're worried about excess quantity in a stream causes erosion in the stream, because the stream's pre-development are made to handle, they come to an equilibrium with the rainfall they get over time. So when you have a lot of hard surface, the theory is, and the actual, this is documented, that the more water you have coming off, the more problems you have. And for instance, I'm not completely convinced, but one of the problems we had right here behind City Hall may be attributed to excess runoff in our watershed. Now, it could be anything else. It could have been a tree stuck in the creek, diverted the flow, and washed out the bank. But that is one way that streams, we have failures in stream banks, and we have erosion, things like that. So what I want to do tonight, I have a video from Virginia that was sponsored to answer any questions to the extent I know. I'm not an expert in low-impact design. I know a little bit about it. One thing before we start, we do have projects in Atascadero that have these low-impact design in them. The new Holiday Inn on West Front Street has a kind of a modified bioswale. It's really meant for sediment. There's every site that gets developed now has stormwater basins to limit the peak flow off the site to pre-development levels. And there's others in town also. So with that, I'm going to start the video. It runs about a half an hour. And we get down to the end, I'll stop it, and you guys can ask all the questions you got. you hear that in the audience?
It's pinging.
Congress's vision of the goal for our nation's water is the restoration and maintenance of the chemical, physical, biological integrity of the nation's water. Have we met that goal yet? Anybody? I don't think so. Programs for the control of non-point sources of pollution be developed and implemented in an expeditious manner. 30 years, and we're still struggling with this issue.
Undisturbed by human activity, Virginia's forests and wetlands absorb and filter rainwater. Water seeps into the ground where it works its way through the soil toward springs and small streams. Released by the soil as sparkling clean water, it becomes a life-giving source during both wet and dry years to thousands of plants' waterways. Streams and rivers quickly rise and flood more often than before development occurred. They also flow at lower levels during dry periods. As communities grow, the hard surfaces of rooftops, roads, and parking lots speed the flow of polluted, untreated stormwater into storm drains or local streams, and ultimately down to the Chesapeake Bay. We now know that damage to our rivers and the Chesapeake Bay is caused by the way we build buildings and develop land. The damage has cost billions of dollars to taxpayers and resulted in the creation of many government regulations. For the past 30 years, while population and development have grown in Virginia, professionals have been studying and designing ways to recreate how forests and wetlands slow down and clean Virginia's stormwater. They know we have to recreate the natural rising and falling of streams and rivers during and after storms. They know we need a system of design strategies that will allow us to develop the land, allow us to lead productive lives, and have clean, drinkable water all at the same time.
I want to introduce the father of modern stormwater management, Bill Schroeder.
We've been implementing our traditional stormwater controls, but we're still seeing degraded environments in our urban streams. We have to start aiming higher in what we're doing. Imagine you as a human being if 90% of your arteries were clogged and we couldn't have a healthy system. If we don't do a good job of protecting these small stream systems, in the U.S., it's 70% of all streams are first and second order streams. So that's something that we really need to be more aggressive on, is protection of these very small urban systems. A developer came in, and this was his approach. Traditional stormwater treatment ponds in the center with 128 lots. We worked with the developer and said, can we give you a better design? It lowered the peak runoff for a two-year storm by 21% just by how you develop the land. His yield went from 128 lots to 138 lots, and the subdivision cost dropped by $1.5 million. What's interesting in this project is the profit margin for the developer went from 24% up to 34%. So he made more money with less impact. I mean, it's a win-win situation.
First step with low impact development is conservation. I'm standing in front of 5 acres of trees we were able to save on this site just through sensitive site planning.
And in Virginia, developers are learning that they too can make more money by conserving land and making more efficient use of land.
We purchased this property, Camp Glenkirk, which consists of 227 acres on the shores of Lake Manassas. We decided to spend the money up front and more detailed engineering to arrive at a more environmentally sensitive land plan for this community. The site is quite unique. It has a eagle's nest on it, matter of fact, two eagle's nests, and it has majority of the site is wetlands. And so by spending the money up front in the engineering, we're able to come up with a land plan that basically saves 55% of the site in open space and becomes a very environmentally friendly community, which we think is a very strong marketplace to sell homes. By using some of the low-impact design techniques that are on the marketplace today, many of those techniques are very, very advantageous to the developer, and we find them financially rewarding to us, too, and we find that it would probably be most advantageous for the homeowner and the consumer at the end.
One of the initial concepts that we had for the project was to do a modified cluster design, which would cluster and condense the area for home ownership to a smaller portion of the site rather than lot it out over the entire site. That gave us control over the preservation of the open space and trees that we have on this property.
The second part of low impact development is minimization of impacts.
A recent study found that the damage done to water quality by every square foot of pavement must be offset by 6 square feet of heavily planted landscape. The most efficient approach to protect our water is to reduce the amount of pavement and the footprint of buildings. There are now alternatives to pavement for roads, driveways, and parking lots that receive only occasional usage. These grass-covered structures are strong enough to hold large vehicles. Where pavement is necessary, there are products that allow water to pass through them into a specially prepared underground system.
Third part of LID is slowing the water down. This is simply done in this case by taking it down.
So you've got a rain barrel, it's large enough, it's freeze-thaw tested, it's UV proof, and it's child proof, it's animal proof, it's mosquito proof.
We have sizes ranging from 30 gallons up to 15,000 gallons. There are many different types of configurations. You can get them in all different types of sizes, dimensions, and also color configurations that match the environment, match the aesthetics of a house. Any type of application where you're wanting to fit it into your environment, that's where it becomes very important to look at that type of detail.
Herbert Dreisaitl is designing systems in Virginia that will integrate stormwater into our daily lives rather than hiding it underground.
I think it is important for people to understand what their water is in front of their doorstep. I think it is important to make it clear that the runoff of water is open to see, is clear for people. They have to get a feeling and an understanding of their environment, and they have to relate to it. It should also be, in a way, funny. It should be interesting. It should be part of our culture. It's something for all.
The fourth step with low impact development is to use integrated management practices where we create storage within the landscape to recreate the storage that was lost when we developed. And this is an example of how we lose storage. This isn't an LID technique. You can see how the landscape is mounded up, so there's no opportunity to treat the water or to store it. Essentially, water just runs off and it's disconnected from the parking lot. A good example here of integrated management practice is a rain garden here with this landscape island. You can see how it's depressed and it has the vegetation growing in it. Curb cuts allow the water to get into this area where it can be treated and stored and provide stormwater management benefits.
The design has been based on improving the water quality of the 0.6 acres. This is a good location for a rain garden because we have got a lot of runoff coming from a parking lot and also from these rooftops and part of the lawn.
all of the stormwater management for this new... In this system, every raindrop that falls comes to the courtyard. Either it falls on the roof of the building and comes down through the downspouts that you see arrayed around the perimeter. It comes then across the shallow runnels set into the sidewalks and feeds the surface of both the green roof and the bioretention. Or the rain that falls in the back in the parking lot, which is behind me through the gate, is caught in a shallow catchment basement and feeds to the surface of the on-grade bioretention.
Well, what we have here is about a one-acre parking lot that drains to the Rappahannock River. There's not much in the way of stormwater management here right now. So we came back and took a look at the site to see where we could apply some LID principles to try and get the water back into the ground and make it function a little more like it did when it was a pre-developed forest. This is where the water goes right now. And what we're going to be doing is taking this green island here and turning it into a functional filter or biofilter. And that's going to happen right here at the curb cut. When all is said and done on this project, the first flush of rainfall is going to enter right through here, and it's going to come back into this excavated area. We've just begun digging it out. Once we get the rest of the soil removed, we are going to take out the existing soil because this is not permeable enough to allow the good type of filtration that we want to have in a biofilter unit. So we're going to take this soil out and then fill it up with the standard bioretention profile, really, which starts with gravel as a sump to hold the water, and then moves up into the bioretention soil mix with mulch on top. And we'll come back in here, plant it with river birch, some blue flag iris, some mulch on top. The whole thing will be depressed about 6 inches below where grade is now. It'll probably only pond for an hour or so after a rainstorm event, but we've taken this parking lot and made it a lot more functional from an LID perspective.
We're in my front yard here in Stafford County, Virginia. We moved here about 2 years ago. And when we first moved in, we had all kinds of drainage problems. None of this landscaping was here, and we had water after heavy rains that would flow and puddle up in the back and create a swamp over here to my right. We were able to solve all those problems and improve our landscaping at the same time by putting in a rain garden in the front yard here, which has added a nice addition to our landscape. Some flowers, some trees, it looks great. In addition, we put a swale in the backyard, runs along the width of our backyard, and that has solved our puddling problems in the back and probably saved the foundation of our house as well. The final thing we did was along the front of the house. We have taken our ditch here.
LA and would create a stormwater management problem. I did put in a bluestone patio, which is just sitting in crushed stone, so it is pervious. But more importantly, all the stormwater that comes from the downspout, from the entire roof runoff, is being directed into this bioretention area right here. Excess water, after it pools here, is directed via this drainage detail over to this site right here, where it is allowed to maintain and to retain and to slowly infiltrate into the ground, just aiding the plant growth. And I have not irrigated this site since I planted it about in April of this year.
We're here in a large commercial parking lot in the city of Fredericksburg. This is really where some of the first LID activities took place in the city. One of the things that you notice when you enter into this area, you see the conventional parking lot islands over my shoulder and the vegetation there. And you contrast that with the bioretention area here in the middle of the parking lot and the vigorous growth that's going on here. This is really one of the many kind of value-added benefits that come along with bioretention systems. Because we're utilizing the stormwater runoff here to irrigate the trees in the parking lot, there's no need for an extensive irrigation infrastructure. That saves money. It also creates much more vigorous growth as the trees remove the nutrients from the runoff, grow much more vigorously, and create an aesthetic asset here in the parking lot. Plenty of shade in what otherwise really is a sea of asphalt. One of the neat things about this project here is that the success of this led the developer, when we worked with them on their next project, to actually decide to go ahead and do complete LID.
I don't know what that means. Well, that concludes our video. Grab the lights, please.
See how extensive the financial crisis is?
I thought he was an engineer.
I deal with rocks and concrete, not bits and bytes, but I appreciate that. So that was our video. Really, we're getting down towards the end anyways, and so that's really kind of some tools, some LID tools. It's
some of us thought you were kidding about a 30-minute video.
No. Well, we were near the end, but one thing I wanted to mention, I did mention some sites, and I thought a little more about some low oil then flow out to our drainage system that we own in the street out to Atascadero Creek. So I just wanted to mention that you have been approving that, and those, as we move forward and our stormwater plan is eventually adopted by the regional board, Regional Water Quality Control Board, you know, we will continue to ask developers and redevelopment in the city to address those issues, address stormwater issues. So with that, do you have any questions?
I think I saw Commissioner O'Grady's hand first.
Yes, Mr. Athey, what's the city's role? What's our role in promoting low-impact design and development?
Our role is to ensure that we comply when our stormwater quality, stormwater management plan is adopted, that we enforce that and that we ensure that not only developers but even ourselves, when we develop and create projects around the city, comply with the plan and limit the impacts on stormwater from either quantity or quality from that standpoint.
Commissioner Hetherington? Okay, Commissioner
first.
O'Keefe?
Thank you. With regard to what you were just saying, how much leeway does the Planning Commission and the City Council have to overrule your recommendations?
Well, I think that, you know, it's within your jurisdiction to adopt and approve plan, you know, developments as you guys see fit, as you know, you're the county, as
okay,
a planning
but,
commission.
But sometimes these things cost more, and I've been sitting here for some time, and recommendations from staff are often ignored by the commissioners and the city council. It just depends upon the composition. Now, there's certain things that we can't do, and my question is with regard to the runoff, how much leeway do we have to overrule your recommendations? I want to know how much teeth there is in this, in a nutshell.
Well, it's my understanding that this stormwater management plan that we have will lay out a series of policies and best management practices, and then staff is going to work with the developers to come up with the best approach of best management practices for each project. So each project, like Dave said, will probably have a slightly different plans, and I think we'll get more information as the plan's approved about exactly how the monitoring is going to work and where the abilities to make adjustments are and where they aren't.
Okay, and then another question. You made a comment, Dave, about the excess watershed runoff from the, you know, that caused, I think the way you phrased is that you thought that some of the problems in the back were caused by excess watershed runoff. Was that further upstream, and what could have been done to have prevented that?
Well, I think what could have been done is the LID. It's what I try to tell people, even myself, I'm learning about it every day, is development in the past started off, say, as a Model T. We had roads, no sidewalks, really just rudimentary dirt roads, cobblestones in the roads. And that was really your Model T. And then along came modern development, which is your 1964 Thunderbird. It's really nice, looks good. It's what we have in El Camino Real right now, curb gutter sidewalk, wide roads, lots of paving. And now we're ending up with the Prius, you know, the regulators, the decision makers in Washington and the state have decided that we can do better on stormwater, and I think we can. And so now we're driving a Prius, and so now the level of development is getting more sophisticated in what we're doing. And actually, kind of go back to your last question just really briefly, is some of these items will cost, do have a cost. I mean, development has a cost in general. there will be reductions in cost also. For instance, we put a lot of curb and gutter in. There's a lot of curb and gutter all over town. Well, a lot of municipalities and counties are moving away from gutters and letting the stormwater flow to grassy swales across sidewalks that are flush with the ground surface. So there will also be reduced costs. So in terms of, now getting back to your question about why wasn't anything done in the past, there was no thought to that. It was like, that's the same question people ask, it's a good question, is why did people just dump, you know, all kinds of chemicals in the back lot of their, you know, businesses? Just no one really knew better. And so now the problem's been identified by US EPA and others on down, and, you know, solutions like this have come forward.
It flowed toward Morrow Road, didn't it? Yeah, and so you had the creek. But with regard to runoff into the creeks, what do we do about that? Because, you know, I mean, water tends to go into our waterways.
Right. So that's what these tools are for. These tools are, for instance, the regional board is asking all the cities and counties in the region, in what they call Region 3, five-county area, to limit the impacts from stormwater quantity, for instance, on these waterways.
Okay, and then another comment. My understanding is that Dove Creek was laid out in such a way as to follow the natural waterway paths and to cluster the housing and things like that. Is that correct, Warren? Even though it was badly maligned because they had to do the over-excavation, that really the layout was very site-sensitive.
I think in terms of the whole project was designed around preserving the creek and the wetlands area, mm-hmm. which is the first thing, is conserve those habitats. And they have large buffers that have all been replanted. And then there's a series of very small detention and desilting basins that take all the water that comes off the roads and perks that or filters it before it gets into the creek. So I think we'll find, if you go out there and look at that project, that a lot of these LID concepts were built into this project.
And yet people have criticized it because they built up, they built small, they did it in little clusters and things like that.
Yeah,
and,
it's a kind of a different project for Atascadero in that it's compact. If you figure we built 270 units on 60 acres and probably 20 of those acres were left at open space, it's a fairly dense project. So it looks different than the development you see on the rolling hills. It kind of looks rural and nice. But in terms of if you're going to try to efficiently use land and maintain some of the habitat areas and creeks, it's actually a very good project in terms of those kind of accomplishments.
Okay. Well, I did want to give a plug for that as opposed to the woodlands where they totally rearranged everything, and in part of it looks like a moonscape up there.
Okay, moving on, Commissioner Hetherington.
Let me begin by thanking you for the presentation, although it was abbreviated. Having been a commissioner for almost a year and asking about pervious zones when we develop and have...
Obispo County, so all the agencies, including the Templeton CSD, meet regularly down in San Luis, typically, talk about stormwater issues that affect all the municipalities. Just quite recently, Jill Falcone from the County of San Luis submitted an application to the Regional Water Quality Control Board for LID assistance in the future, and she did that on behalf of all the partners. So as time moves on, and Jill, myself, Templeton, Paso Robles identify a specific need, let's say a total Upper Salinas watershed analysis. That's just an example. It's nothing we have planned, but something like that. We could apply to the regional board for LID assistance in coming up with some type of LID plans that are site-specific that could actually be used in the county right next south of Atascadero, or in Atascadero, or east of Atascadero, to achieve the same type of goals, so of reducing impacts on creeks. So we're pursuing that. Prop 84 is coming forward, and in the next grant cycle, I believe, And so there will be an opportunity to apply for grants from Prop 84 also. So we're looking at all the different angles and trying to leverage our dollars, you know, our staff time, along with another one that's come up is the County of San Luis, through a grant from the Regional Water Quality Control Board, have developed a low-impact development manual. Paso Robles, I believe, has signed on to get that tailored to their city, and we're kind of in the same discussion right now with the county and the regional board about possibly getting some of that assistance or that manual for Atascadero. And that would really be implemented through our engineering standards for the city.
Will part of the Prop 84 money be available to assist developers in maybe rephasing their projects to include low-impact development standards?
I don't know.
Okay. If you could check into that, David, sure. I'd be really excited to know that. And my final question is, when can we start suggesting to development projects that, you know, low-impact design and development is the future, and we would like to work with you to make this happen?
Well, like I mentioned before, we already do that with the stormwater coming, and you're going to have to deal with these issues along with the city staff and to come up with good solutions for their projects.
Commissioner Marks?
Yes, thank you, David. Other than the manual you mentioned, how is staff becoming aware of BMPs? Is there some sort of training?
Well, I haven't attended any training at this point, but I do interface with all the city engineers throughout the county. I get a lot of on-the-job training really from consultants who come in. A lot of the consultants around here are really on board. They're aware of LID. They're aware of these regulations. They know they're coming. So we actually get a lot of proposals from them. You know, this is how we want to deal with it. We don't, you know, I think from my standpoint, I don't want to tell somebody how exactly to comply. I want to say, here's a standard that we have to deal with, effectively. How are you going to do it? For instance, on the Rite Aid site, they came forward. We said, hey, you know, we want you to treat your parking lot runoff here at behind the store. How are you going to do that? And so they came forward and provided us with designs for bioswale. So we looked at that, and we approved their design, and you know, now they're going to move forward when they get their building permit and put that in.
Very good. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I believe we have someone from the public that had a question. Sir?
I'm just waiting for when you're ready to take comments. I'm Matt Thompson. I'm the program manager with the Stormwater Program at the Central Coast Water Board.
Go right ahead.
I'd be happy to answer any questions. That's actually why I came. Thanks for having me. Like I said, I'm the Stormwater Program Manager of the Central Coast Water Board. I'm a registered civil engineer. I basically came to hear any concerns that you guys might have regarding low-impact development and take them back and report back to the others in the group. I was also hoping to answer any questions you might have regarding the Water Board's expectations that land be developed in a manner that protects watershed functions. I should mention a few things. I'll try and fill in some of the holes, like questions you asked, Pam. But before I do, before I avail myself for questions, I wanted to say a few things. First, you know, the function of the Water Board is to protect water bodies. That's our Statute Coast region that do not currently have NPDES permit coverage, that they revise their stormwater management programs to commit to develop what we call interim hydromodification control criteria within 1 year of stormwater management program adoption. Our intent is to work with city staff here to revise the city's stormwater management program such that it will be approvable by the Water Board by February 2009. So that what that means is that by February 2010, we would expect the city to develop criteria that would effectively require developers to do low-impact development. We are currently working with cities that are already doing it. City of Salinas, the County of Santa Cruz is already doing it. The City of Santa Barbara is already doing it, and as is the County of San Luis Obispo. And the way they're doing it is through development of what they call low-impact development manuals or stormwater development standards. They're basically alternatives to engineering standards. Atascadero has some antiquated engineering standards that in some ways conflict with low-impact development principles. So Atascadero may have to do the same. Paso Robles realized they have to do it, and so what they did is, well, let me back up. The County of San Luis Obispo committed to developing low-impact design manual with a grant from the Water Board. The Water Boards, through Proposition 40, gave them $400,000 to prepare an LID manual and to do a demonstration project in both Templeton and Santa Margarita. They're wrapping up that LID manual now, and it looks pretty good. Paso Robles has asked Wallace Group, who prepared the LID manual, to give them an estimate of what it would cost to tailor that to the city of Paso Robles. And Wallace Group told them they could do it for $5,000. That seems like a fairly meager cost to comply with NPDES requirements. The second thing we're doing is trying to provide technical assistance. The Water Board established an endowment and some seed funding to establish the Central Coast Low Impact Development Center. The purpose of the Low Impact Development Center is to provide technical assistance to municipalities to figure out how to write it into their ordinances, to provide assistance to developers where they could come with a project plan and they can figure out how they could tweak it to better. That is coming down in the spring. Historically, the Central Coast cities have not really benefited from that because you kind of have to pay to play to get these grants. You have to commit to writing a grant proposal in order to get the grant. And so traditionally, the large metropolitan areas benefit from these grants. And so what we have done is we've used some of our funding to provide assistance to municipalities for grant writers. We're saying we'll basically give money to you, the city, to get a grant writer in here to help you compete for Proposition 84 funding. Again, we're waiting for interested entities to apply for that grant funding. We learned this week that the County of San Luis Obispo is partnering with the County of Santa Barbara and the City of Santa Maria to develop what they call a hydromodification management plan for the Santa Maria watershed. I would think that the North County municipalities and the County of San Luis Obispo and the Templeton Community Services District could do the same for the Upper Salinas watershed. That's one suggestion on how to, you know, get a regional hydromodification planning going on. And lastly, I wanted to mention that you heard it mentioned in the video that it can actually be less expensive than conventional development. I brought several copies of an EPA study that came out in December 2007 where they evaluated 17 low-impact development projects from across the United States and compared the life cycle cost to those developments to conventional development. And they found that, in general, low-impact development was less expensive than conventional development due to reduced site work. You're basically moving less soil around. You're minimizing imperviousness, so there's less hardscape, and there's less underground infrastructure. And the study also found that the other benefits of low-impact development include improved aesthetics, expanded recreational opportunities, increased property values due to the desirability of the lots and their proximity to open space, increased total number of units developed, increased marketing potential, and faster sales. And I brought copies of these study results. Indeed, one developer has actually caught this. Dick Wilhoyt of Estrella Associates in Paso Robles is planning to do full-blown low-impact development in a 1,200-home development there in the northeast part of Paso Robles. He sees it as a sort of marketing thing, not necessarily an environmental thing. So I have copies of that study, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have. Thanks.
I think we all have questions on that one. Let's start with someone who has not had a chance, Commissioner, at home.
Yeah, you mean is the developer creating a more desirable neighborhood? Well, we've learned in Seattle, where they retrofitted a street, they call it the Street Edge Alternatives Project. They ripped out a conventional curb and gutter street and replaced it with some low-impact development, sort of a sinuous road with really narrow sidewalks and no curb and gutter so it could sheet flow off into the surrounding vegetation. They found that that neighborhood is now, that street is now the most desirable neighborhood in the area, and that they are, the property values have gone up. So I don't know if that directly answers your question, but yeah, the property values could increase.
Well, and I'm thinking, too, when you're initially developing something, the initial cost to the first buyer is going to be more. I mean, we've been talking about, you know, low-income housing and things are affordable housing, and so not that I'm against the stormwater management and the LID. I'm just bringing up something that came to mind that might be an issue. The second thing, and it might be more of a staff question with regards to this, is I'm assuming this is all for new development, but if somebody, you know, a homeowner pulls a permit, do they suddenly come under the, you know, the phase two, whatever, the plan that we're putting in place and then have requirements in terms of their property to come into compliance?
We haven't worked that out yet, but the regional board has indicated, yes, that redevelopment would trigger some form of stormwater control at that development.
Okay. Thank you.
Could I touch on that quickly? The Regional Water Board just adopted stormwater development standards for the city of Salinas, where they had the same concern about redevelopment. They're trying to kind of improve their downtown core. And the way they dealt with that issue of redevelopment is that they developed what they call applicability criteria, such that the low-impact development requirements don't apply to projects of a certain size. In Salinas' case, it only applied to projects that added 5,000 square feet of impervious surface or more. So if they're basically replacing like a downtown parking lot with a mixed-use project and there was no net increase in impervious surface, they would not be subject to the low-impact development requirements.
And so that would be up to the city to put into their plan that would then be approved by Regional Water Quality, correct?
That's right. We're asking the city of Atascadero to prepare their own applicability criteria.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Commissioner Marks, are you poised there?
Yes.
Matt, I thought I heard you say
less than conventional development.
Okay.
I presume that would translate to less cost for the homeowner, but I can't say that.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Other questions? Commissioner Jack?
What kind of enforcement options are envisioned?
Enforcement options to enforce these requirements?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, let me explain the nuts and bolts a little bit. In order for the Water Board to approve a stormwater management program, they have to determine that that program meets the Water Board standard called maximum extent practicable, which takes into a lot of account like economics and that sort of thing. This Water Board has established through, I think, 4 years of give and take with entities in the Monterey area and such, that a stormwater management program will not meet the MEP, the maximum extent practicable standard, unless it effectively conditions development to protect watersheds. So if the city of Atascadero were not to commit to controlling hydromodification, they could not be enrolled under the NPDES permit, and so they would essentially have some liability issues there because they are essentially discharging stormwater waste without the protection of a federal permit. At this point, we have not envisioned what enforcement tools we were to use were a particular entity not to come along. Okay. That's where we are now.
Thank you.
Commissioner Hetherington.
Thanks for coming, Matt. I get all excited when I think about stormwater runoff and how we're going to be dealing with it. I know the Habitat for Humanity homes are integrating those types of low-impact design and development, and that keeps their prices down and the maintenance down over the long haul. I guess my question to you and my ask of you is that the EPA studies, are those, they're not copyright protected. They could be handed out to developers when they come in. so the city could just photocopy them and make sure that when a project comes forward or a, you know, perceived project, they could be given that document.
Correct.
And I would hope that staff would do that.
Commissioner O'Keefe?
Yes, you made the
to essentially put in a detention basin to just capture all that runoff and just bleed it out over a longer period of time. That is not low-impact development. Low-impact development is about disconnecting impervious surfaces and maximizing infiltration. It's about decentralizing those stormwater controls out into the project. So that's an example. The detention basins are the 1960s Thunderbird that needs to be upgraded.
Are there any others that stand out?
Well, I mean, yeah, you have, for in the right-of-way, you have engineering standards that, that prescribe curb and gutter in some settings that might need to be revisited.
Any others? I mean, because we're not aware of this.
I'm not aware of the engineering standards for every city.
I understand but that, but yours, when some of these things come up, it gives us an opportunity then to question and say, well, have you, you know, what would be involved in some modifications?
Sure. Well, what would be involved it would be to prepare a low-impact development manual that you can hand to applicants, project applicants, that they could follow to properly incorporate LID into their project. Right now, they don't have anything like that.
Okay. Thank you.
Commissioner Jack?
Could I just say something about the engineering standards? I kind of take a little pride.
Go ahead. This is the way I get information.
Matt is 99% correct, 99.99. I disagree that actually curb and gutters are totally antiquated. There are situations where you could use a curb and gutter or even have a sidewalk curb and gutter and incorporate LID principles, say, in a parking lot where there's curb and gutter, but you have pervious pavement, and that handles your stormwater. So curbs and gutters is just like another tool. It's a tool to move stormwater from point A to point B. Now, what you do to limit the quantity and the quality in between point A and point B, that I think that goes to the low-impact development and how we're going to handle that. So curb and gutters are still useful, and I just want to make sure you guys know that, and that as these new standards come out, we will incorporate those into our engineering designs. It's just another tool. So those aren't going to
be enrolling under has some criteria. It would not apply to, like, the tiniest projects. I don't have that at the top of my head, but yeah, we would expect the city to develop their own applicability criteria, but we would expect it to be reasonable.
Yeah. Thank you.
Commissioner O'Grady.
I really appreciate the approach your agency is taking. As a career design engineer, I've dealt with all kinds of codes and standards, many of which are prescriptive. They tell you what to do and how to do it and don't give you any flexibility. And this is more performance-based, as I understand it. And also the way it's being promulgated, you are approaching our city and asking for their input and how they see best able to meet some of this performance criteria. So, because some of us folks in the Atascadero don't appreciate some outside government agencies coming in here and telling us exactly what we're supposed to do. So and as an engineer, I appreciate having the flexibility to be able to tailor the solutions to the particular project. And so I just wanted to commend you on your approach here, and not focus too much on the specifics of it, but. So I appreciate that.
Commissioner Marks?
Yes, thank you. Matt, I heard you mention a program that I think would ultimately save this city a tremendous amount of money, and that is providing funding for agencies to actually hire grant writers.
Yeah.
Could you explain a little bit about that?
Yeah, sorry, I was feeling kind of rushed to tell you about that. Proposition 84 is coming down in the spring. We expect State Water Resources Control Board to release guidelines this winter, which will basically tell the regulated community how they intend to award the money. We've been working with State Board to ensure that, well, not ensure, but to encourage them to direct that money towards implementation of large-scale, low-impact development projects, okay? That being said, Central Coast Region is really neat because we haven't completely destroyed our watersheds yet, and there are a lot of communities here that are poised from our Guadalupe Fund. The Water Board recently approved this, which allowed us to hire a lady named Monica Reed with Kestrel Consulting, who's probably one of the best grant writers in the state, to basically come alongside any community that is willing to do LID to help, and she will help facilitate and actually write the grant proposal on our dime. The county of San Luis Obispo has already stepped up with the concept proposal, as has the Santa Cruz County Resource Conservation District on behalf of all the communities in that county. So I would think, I guess what I'm saying is I'm encouraging Atascadero to consider pursuing this opportunity as well.
In these grants that a grant writer would write, would ask for funding to prepare the manual we need to prepare?
Correct.
Okay. Very good. Well, thanks very much.
Commissioner Jack?
One quick question. If I wanted to do some research and find out more about what we've been talking about tonight, where would I go? What would be one or two good sources of information for how we got there, the requirements, what the end goals are?
Sure. Yeah, low impact development was kind of born out of the Eastern Seaboard in the Virginia and Maryland areas. And there's a clearinghouse for all low impact development information, and it's called the Low Impact Development Center of Maryland. Their website, I believe, is lowimpactdevelopment.org. And they are kind of a clearinghouse for all kinds of manuals on how to do this. A second resource, the gentleman in the video, one of the gentlemen's name was Larry Kaufman. Larry Kaufman runs an organization called the Center for Watershed Protection, and they are also in Maryland. And I would look up their website. I don't know the address, but you have to Google it. But that's the Center for Watershed Protection. And as a side note, you should know the new stormwater management programs have several components. There's only six of them. I won't name them, but the one we're talking about is post-construction runoff control. And what we expect the stormwater management program to contain in that element of the stormwater management program is a commitment, just a commitment, to develop interim hydromodification control criteria within 1 year of stormwater management program approval. So, in other words, by February 2010, the city of Atascadero would have to develop a suite of requirements that effectively protect watersheds. This is the performance-based requirements that we're talking about. They have to be numeric and they have to be enforceable. They have to be the type of requirements that a plan checker could pick up and compare to a plan and easily determine compliance with. Those are expectations. We call them interim hydromodification control requirements because we understand that in the long term, Atascadero is going to want to develop something that is much more specific to their unique hydrology. And so what Atascadero is probably going to have to do in that first year is to basically look at what similar communities are doing and use similar requirements.
What we have heard, and this is just the rumor mill, of course, is that our storm drains are very antiquated, and they are, of course, very, very old, and they lead through downtown into the creek area, and so there's a lot of runoff that goes straight into the creek. Does this requirement mean that the whole storm drain system has to be revamped?
Absolutely not.
That's good.
We're talking about new development and redevelopment.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you said post-development. This is where I'm trying to catch and understand, because post-development could mean anything. It could mean a downtown that's already developed.
Correct. But we understand that, you know, new standards would only apply to new development and redevelopment. It's most cost-effective to apply these standards to new development. It's going to be a lot more expensive for places like City of Santa Barbara, who's committing to going back, actually retrofitting large parts of town.
We're
allowing Atascadero to develop their own applicability criteria. That on-site system, as we call it, complies with our basin plan requirements. I see no changes there. I see no kind of interplay between low-impact development requirements and on-site system requirements.
Okay, very good. You mentioned some percentages of impervious surfaces on lots of various sizes. Is that something that's a standard that's coming our way?
Yeah. I mean, low-impact development is about minimizing imperviousness, minimizing and disconnecting imperviousness, I should say. And like I said, we expect numeric enforceable criteria. You could write a requirement that says limit imperviousness, and a designer wouldn't know what that means. So, alternatively, you could say limit effective impervious area to 5% of total project area. What that means is that you have to basically run parking lots into vegetated strips and bioswales before they run right into the street, to give it an opportunity to soak into the ground before it connects up with the storm drain system. We are by no means limiting. There's an assumption that we're only allowing, I've heard talk that we're only allowing 5% of a lot to be developed with impervious surface. That's not accurate. Effective impervious area is a different concept.
So if I understand what you're stating, is that the imperviousness of a lot could be mitigated through certain measures?
Correct.
Okay, very good. And elimination of curbs and gutters sounds like it's part of the newer development, and of course Mr. Athey has stated that they may be integrated in as long as they're mitigated again. But what about existing curbs and gutters? Will they remain, or they will be eventually phased out under your plan?
Well, again, we don't get to that level of detail. Again, we would expect the city to develop their own redevelopment criteria. We're not asking the City of Atascadero to go in and rip out existing curb and gutter. We're asking them to plan new and redevelopment differently.
Okay, and one last question. Atascadero is rather unique in that we have a lot of springs. Do you have any mitigation for springs, or how do you incorporate them into this kind of a plan?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. David mentioned that low-impact development is a drainage tool. I agree with that, but I think it's more than that. I think low-impact development is a planning tool. You have to consider low-impact development principles.
But I understand what you're saying. Are there any other questions for Matt? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Does that conclude the presentation?
Yes, that concludes my presentation.
Very
Thank
good.
You.
Thank you so much. That was a very good presentation, very reassuring to some of us that had some doubts and questions about it. Is there any commissioner comments or reports? Commissioner O'Grady.
Two meetings ago, I asked Public Works Director Kahn, past Public Works Director Kahn, I guess, about light poles that were stockpiled along Morrow Road. And if I recall, Director Kahn indicated that he would be contacting Caltrans, whose poles he thought they were, and report back to the commission about getting those removed to an appropriate storage location. Is there anything staff can report at this time?
No, I'll check on that, and we'll get you a formal report back.
There's now an added flatbed trailer there by the poles. I didn't know whether to take that as an encouraging sign or not, but second question. I'm getting a lot of questions these days about what's going to happen with projects like the Printery, Eagle Creek, and Colony Square, just to think of three that folks have asked me about just this last week. And so I'd like to get back to them and just tell them whatever you tell me.
Well, Colony Square is a theater project over here. We're working closely with the architect on a minor redesign of the exterior to reduce the office component, make the project more financeable. I know the city manager's office is also working with some local banks to help to arrange some financing that's more suitable for the project. We also know that the theater operator has hired an architect who's preparing the interior plans for the theater. So we expect both the redesign for the exterior building and the interior theater plans to come in. They told us by the end of September. So that's a real good sign. They're moving forward with the construction of the theater. We expect that within the next 3 to 4 months, some financial problems at this point. On the Printery project, we have not had the resubmittal of the plans. I think we are at a point now where I'll have to check to see if the permits are still active or if we have a expired permit. I can't recall off the top of my head there. There is issues with the Printery. We have briefed the council a number of times on it. The council has given direction to the city attorney to look into some different issues related to the deed restriction, the historic nature of the building. So we're well aware of the Printery issues, and staff and the city attorney are looking into that in terms of what the options are on that project. The Eagle Creek project is not moving forward at this point. The council approved the general plan amendment, called for a subdivision and re-landscaping or restoration of the golf course site, and then conversion of the shop building and the clubhouse into residential units. At this point, the plans and maps were submitted earlier this year. They all had corrections. They haven't come back in. So that project at this point, the permits aren't expired, but there's no active work on them at this point.
A question. Are both the Printery and Eagle Creek projects still controlled by developer Kelly Gearhart?
Well, they're both owned by LLCs of different names.
Oh.
So you have to chase out the LLCs.
Okay. But there's a difference in the status of the two projects, if I understood you correctly. In other words, the city has some interest here and is having an attorney pursue that, whereas Eagle Creek, it's in the residence court to do something. I mean, because I'm getting asked questions by residents who live near that Eagle Creek.
The city has different interests in the projects. On the Printery, there's a deed restriction. It's a historic resource, and that deed restriction's in the favor of the city. So that was recorded to make sure the building was maintained, and there are some concerns about that. So that's why the city attorney is involved in that. On Eagle Creek, we have a concern that we don't want it to turn into a nuisance, per se. The fire department has gone out there and done weed abatement this year so that the weeds didn't become a hazard or nuisance to that degree.
You said Walmart had, I don't quite know how to articulate it, but Walmart and Rotman were trying to figure out how they were going to proceed. Could you clarify that? Because I don't have a good idea.
Staff has met with Rotman and Walmart, and Walmart's still committed to their project as designed. They're anxious to move forward. Rotman is doing a slight redesign of their portion of the project, so Walmart wants to wait until Rotman gets his redesign done. We're expecting that comes in the next 60 days or so.
Okay.
Commissioner O'Keefe?
I just want to add something regarding the printery. I do think the public I wanted to add something regarding the printery, and Warren rightfully is being cautious about what he says. However, there's a $4.5 million loan that was taken out. Investors invested in that, and really nothing has been done, nor have the taxes been paid on the printery since it was taken over by Mr. Gerhardt. So there's $35,000 due in back taxes on that. And I do have a question with regard to the weed abatement. If the fire department did it, the weed abatement, does that go on his tax? Is the city going to try to collect for that, or did they just do that without charging?
No. On all the weed abatements, and we did quite a few this year, and we do quite a few every year, that's a tax lien, and there's a state law that the city is paid on the next tax roll. So we get that money whether or not the property owner actually pays their taxes.
Okay, and then I have some additional details regarding the Eagle Creek, but I'll talk to you privately about that.
Any other comments or reports? Seeing none, I adjourn the meeting at 9:20.